Owensboro, December. Kentucky's third largest city, though a little smaller than nearby Evansville, has a vaguely bohemian air to it. Owensboro had its moments of fame. Its courthouse was burned by Confederate raiders during the Civil War, and once, at the turn of the 20th century, it had been shaping up to be one of the pivot points of the new automobile industry before being eclipsed by Ford in Detroit. It was also notable for being the site of the last public hanging in the United States, that of Rainey Bethea for the rape and murder of a septuagenarian named Leisha Edwards in the 1930s. If Lexington is more bustling, thanks to its status as a transport hub linking the Georgia Control and the rest of the Middle and Deep South Korean zones with the Ordnance and others to the north, and Louisville more industrious because of the huge legworm rendering plants that turn quasi-insectoid flesh and a corn syrup sauce into wham, Owensboro is proud of its cultural heritage. It prides itself on barbecue and bluegrass, and even in the reduced circumstances of the Korean era, still manages to hold a few festivals a year dedicated to food and drink. Now it is a popular watering hole for wealthy members of the Northwest Ordnance, visiting from their vast homes and ranches in the delightful hills of southern Kentucky and the bluegrass outside Louisville. They enjoy the nominally illicit thrill of a visit across the river to dine and shop. The back door and under-the-table nature of the commerce along Owensboro's main street is the sizzle for goods that are often counterfeit, courtesy of the wily Kentuckians. The Greek olive oil is from Georgia, the Colombian coffee from Alabama, and the Swiss chocolate could be bought 10 times cheaper in Pennsylvania. The gold in the quarter bars allegedly taken from Fort Knox is real enough. The identifying stamps aren't. The bourbon, musical instruments, and barbecue sauce is real, however, as is the Kentucky weed. For some reason, plants that have been grown from seeds that pass through the digestive tract of a legworm are considered more valuable. The giant sassafras tree, according to the locals, the largest in the world, is still standing. It was recently the site of another public hanging, that of one of the moondaggers from the nearby power plant who'd gone over the fence, only to be run down by the city's impromptu militia, mobilized to render aid to Southern Command in the return of their plant workers. The city is quieter than usual this December. Though often subdued in the winter, this time around, the city is in lockdown. It's not the troubles at the power plant, or the revolt in Evansville, or the proximity of the forces of Southern Command that has closed the bridge and wharf to Korean Order traffic. It is the great groups of strangers of all varieties coming in, from long-haired legworm ranchers to statuesque urbane females with gleaming leather courier bags and attractive wool suits. There's a good deal of speculation about who the strangers are. The locals, for all their guitar picking and hurdy-gurdy cranking and trucks with smuggling compartments over the axles, are keener observers of Kentucky politics than it might seem. They suspect that they're playing host to the Kentucky Assembly, but are willing to let history be made before they start talking about it in the main street's many cafes and bandstand joints. The Crucible Legion, as it was now being styled, had its first field operation providing security on the streets of Owensboro. Valentine had a standing order to put anyone who called it Valentine's Legion to work filling potholes, and it didn't take many days of punishment with wheelbarrow and shovel before the name disappeared. Both the informal name and the formal request to go to Owensboro had come through Brother Mark, who decamped without a moment's rest to the assembly at Elizabethtown and engineered its move to Owensboro. Valentine and Lambert allocated 2 companies to the security detail, one to provide a presence on the streets in town, and a second in reserve just to the west, ready to move to the West Bridge or travel on the Owensboro bypass as needed. Valentine gave the street detail's command to Ediak, and Patel's company had the reserve duty. Ediak had an intelligent charm about her that would mix well with civilians, and Patel could be relied upon to get his men from A to B in a hurry if it became necessary. Valentine had little to do but get to know the town and keep his men from talking too much in the bars or being too high profile on the streets. The soldiers of the Legion had the unusual orders to keep out of the establishments of the downtown they were guarding. He felt odd patrolling a town not in Southern Command control, but as the Owensboro Emergency Council explained it, the delegates didn't trust some of the hotheads in the more vociferous clans not to try to storm the convention center and force the vote their way at gunpoint. While the forces of Southern Command couldn't be called neutrals in Kentucky politics, they were famous for letting the civilians carry out votes without anything more than a soldier's fatalistic interest in the events of elected officials. All Valentine soldiers could do was provide an illusion of security. They stood in pairs and trios on the street corners and walked through the old town square and along the rusted, broken riverwalk. But if a file of Northwest Ordnance gunboats came chugging down the Ohio, all they could do was point the delegates to their designated bomb proofs. Of course, an illusion could be a powerful thing, as Valentine had learned at substantial pain in the Curran Zone. Owensboro had a police force, of sorts, who appeared to have one law for the town's residents and another for strangers and transients. Valentine had to keep in the good graces of the local police captain, his deputies, and his detectives, who, as far as Valentine could tell, were in charge of extorting money from the shadier local establishments. The Kentucky Assembly met at the Waterfront Conference Center that played host to Owensboro's famous flea markets. Instead of socks and shoelaces and genuine Japanese electric razors, they traded votes during the day and drinks at night. Valentine set up his command post in the Old Town Welcome Center right on the main street, with a good view of his observation post on the old severed bridge over the Ohio that ran into the center of town. The Welcome Center had become a sort of lounge for restaurant and accommodation touts and cab drivers. The touts and drivers were so busy with the Kentucky Assembly in town, they had no need of a place to sit out of weather and swap lies about their clients, and Valentine had moved in without any protest. Brother Mark had arrived on a coal train with a few other delegates, including Tika, now dressed in an impressive mix of cotton, legworm leather, and riding boots that made Valentine think of a dashing flying ace of the First World War. She looked Valentine levelly in the eye and shook his hand before excusing herself.
That bright young woman's building an army for Kentucky. Or an army of Kentucky, though they haven't settled on a name.
Hope word doesn't get out.
Kentucky is turning into the proverbial tar baby for the Curran Order. They're like Br'er Fox getting stuck in the tar.
I think the version I heard had Br'er Rabbit getting stuck. Br'er Fox wins one for a change.
Well, either way, the analogy is sound. Every time the Currans try to attack Kentucky, they only get themselves stuck in worse trouble. They sent the Moondaggers in after us, and they perpetrated outrages against a people that tend to pick up their guns and let the lead fly until the point of honor is settled. Just when matters were beginning to calm down, they tried their gambit at the power plant. Now all of Kentucky is talking about that over their back fences and cracker barrels.
I've yet to see a cracker barrel my whole time in Kentucky.
Yes, yes. Well, you know what I mean. But they're stuck in worse now. The bombing of Elizabethtown is another example. It united the delegates just as it chased them out of the city. Half were ready to break off and go home until the bombs started falling.
And delivered them right into our lap.
You're a victim of your own success, my daring Valentine. All Elizabethtown spoke of the way you handled the power plant difficulty, and that smothered the idea of moving to Bowling Green or Danville. When planes hit the conference center unexpectedly again in a night raid, they decided to relocate in secret to Owensboro. We picked up two more legworm clans and several of the towns in the south. The only major holdouts are the towns in the Cincinnati-Louisville-Lexington triangle, but you can hardly blame them, practically in the shadow of all those Curran towers.
There was still a pretense of an assembly going on in Elizabethtown, complete with press notices. A radio broadcaster calling himself Dr. Samuel Johnson. Valentine had no idea if that was his real name or not, but he felt as though he should know the name. Continued to report jumbled details and play recorded interviews allegedly obtained in Elizabethtown over what was probably Free Kentucky's only computer telephone line hookup. Of course, Curran agents were hunting all around Elizabethtown for the site of the assembly, probably so it could be targeted for bombing again. But for now, the decampment to Owensboro and the new swearing-in of delegates at the high school basketball court had remained a secret. They kept an underground special radio in Valentine's city headquarters for listening to Dr. Johnson's daily report. Valentine, who was right in Owensboro with the assembly meeting only around the corner from him, knew more about how the debate was progressing from a transmitter in Elizabethtown than he did from local reports. Odd world. But he'd noted that before. There didn't seem to be much for his security team to do. In the end, his one great contribution was to take Pencil Bolnitz off the hands of the assembly security team. Bolnitz snuck into the assembly once, was warned off, and was escorted out. When he got in again the very same day, the assembly sergeant-at-arms demanded that he never see Bolnitz's classic profile again. Valentine had the journalist put under guard and walked back to Fort Singh. Even Brother Mark wouldn't update Valentine on the real progress of the debate. Valentine plied him with food and even had Ediac cut and style his hair. Strange duty for someone with captain's bars, but she was as curious as Valentine about the progress of the debate and was willing to play sort of a Mata Hari with comb and straight razor.
Sworn to secrecy, I'm afraid. Everyone's afraid of an opinion getting back to the Kurians. There's a rule, until the actual assembly vote, that none of the voting on motions and so on is to be recorded or reported. My, look at all this gray hair.
But Dr. Johnson's sources keep giving him a sense of the assembly.
Dr. Johnson is not necessarily accurate in his reports, Captain Ediac. Remember, he's also reporting that they're meeting in an undisclosed location outside Elizabethtown.
Well, that's true after a fashion. About 80 miles outside Elizabethtown.
Why didn't they do this last summer?
Karras was operating on his own hook with his own allied clans. But some of Kentucky supported him and started putting together a democratic assembly, on paper, at least. The assembly is almost feudal, going back to the traditions of the Magna Carta. This is a collection of powerful and influential men and women. Kentucky's nobility, you might say.
You wouldn't know it by how they're spending in town.
They're afraid to show their faces. If you see a man hurrying down the street with his collar turned up and his hat pulled down, I guarantee that's an assembly member.
Brother Mark was willing to brief them on general parameters of the debate. There were three broad factions in the assembly: the Old Deal Caucus, the Militant Independents, and the All-Ins. According to Brother Mark, the future of Kentucky would be determined by which way the Militant Independents voted.
Hard to say what'll tip the balance. The Kurians seem to have finally figured out that threatening Kentucky is causing more problems than it's solved.
The debate was raging among the people as well. Dr. Johnson, when he had no news to report, read letters and notes from a few phone calls and even news reports from overseas. Of course, there was no knowing just how much the good doctor was editorializing, but the vast majority of the messages he read were in favor of Kentucky declaring itself against the Kurians, though there were mixed feelings about whether they should join the United Free Republics or no. The United Free Republics, as it turned out, suddenly developed a diplomatic interest in the situation in Kentucky. One blustery afternoon, a civilian of Valentine's acquaintance named Simmy pulled up outside the command center. Valentine hadn't seen vehicles like this since driving Fran Paoli's big Lincoln out of ordnance on Halloween night. The one at the front was marred by a big brush cutter. The passenger van at the rear bore a medical Red Cross. All were excessively dirty. The convoy's passengers included more than a dozen security men and aides dressed in the ordinary buttoned, collarless shirt and denims, corduroys, and moleskins of the Kentuckians. Simmy checked in at Valentine's security office while his men waited outside. Valentine wasn't sure how he felt about the man. In some ways, they were similar. In age, melting pot heritage, Simmy a dark chocolate and Valentine a native bronze, and general height and build. There were contrasts. Simmy was smooth-skinned, Valentine scarred, Simmy bald, Valentine long-haired. Valentine found Simmy's usual scent of sandalwood and gentleman's talc appealing. More important, every time Valentine became involved with Simmy, Valentine seemed to end up in deeper difficulty. Now Simmy was giving him the additional headache of keeping tabs on one of Southern Command's bigger political bugs.
Your hotel has quite a check-in procedure, Major Valentine. I hope its water pressure is just as good. I could use a shower.
There's hot water in the washroom, Simmy. Best I can do. You're gonna have difficulty finding accommodations in town unless you want to squat in a rat run or take charity. You're welcome to stay on base, but it's a 2-hour drive to Fort Singh.
We can sleep in the vehicles. They're rigged for it.
I don't suppose they're rigged to carry medical goods and antibiotics. We could really use some.
Yes, we'll spare what we can. I've brought you the latest rabies vaccine, too.
New strain loose?
You'll have to ask the doctor. I believe it's just this year's booster.
We could really use a doctor at the post.
I thought you had support from Evansville.
It's a small manufacturing city. And even that's not much good without raw materials. I don't want to strip the town of what little they have for their own people. And it helps to have a doctor who has to obey orders.
Personnel isn't my specialty. Remember, I'm not here to support your guerrillas, or Legion Etrangere, or whatever you're running here.
What are you going to tell the Assembly?
What do you think I'll tell them?
A rousing speech promising the friendship of the free republics, as long as that friendship doesn't get measured in boot heels over the river?
I may just surprise you. I hope you come and hear it.
I'm afraid they won't let me in.
The man handling security for the town? I'll see what I can do.
Seems to me everything you've been involved in has been a disaster for Southern Command. Kansas, Javelin. What about the offensive in the Rio Grande Valley? Your handiwork too?
You earned your dislike, Valentine. Maybe one of these days you'll grow up and realize I'm in the same fight as you. I can't swing a blade, and I shoot like a cross-eyed man, and I'd be dead in a week if I had to eat preserved ration concentrate and wham. But I know people, and I can read my audience.
Yeah, bet that comes in handy when a reaper tears the roof off your house.
Maybe I'm better equipped for fighting the kind of battles the Currians wage. They don't put, what's that phrase, shit on target? They'd rather make their target give up and go home, or do a deal that swaps a few lives, a few towns, for a generation's security. Like you, I'm ready to make sacrifices for victory, Major. I was ready to give you up to get Kansas. And if I could trade your life for a different outcome in Kansas, I would, like a shot.
Feelings mutual.
Would you now, if it came to it? If you could get the high country of Kansas back for us by just putting that pistol to my head and squeezing the trigger, would you?
It's never that easy.
Your father would have.
He never told me anything at all.
Not firsthand, but I know the history. He was what we call a plantation burner. Left a lot of scorched earth and scorched bodies behind. But it made the Currians pull out of most of Missouri. I won't argue the results. I'm sorry if he told you different, but that's the truth of the matter. You a fan of football, Valentine?
I know the basics, but I never had much time to follow it.
I'm a big fan. We have some fair mud leagues running the spine from Little Rock to Texarkana. I'm a buzzsaw man myself.
I've heard of them. I think they won the championship a few years back.
2 seasons ago. Every good team needs what I like to call a hatchet. With the buzzsaws, it's a linebacker. It's the crazy mean player, the guy who puts people down for a game or two. So instead of covering assignments, the opposing team's eyeing the hatchet, wondering who's going to be broken next. Bad sportsmanship? Maybe. But I've learned something before I started shaving my gray hairs. Most good organizations have a hatchet or two to do the dirty work. You'd make a pretty good hatchet. You have the right name anyway, thanks to your father's, well, fierce reputation.
Well, I always thought of myself as more of a screwdriver. Always being used for jobs other than the one I'm designed to do.
Simi was good to his word. An assembly ID showed up for Valentine the next day. Though he had to report to the assembly's own sergeant-at-arms to get his picture taken with a Polaroid and have a card made. The assembly itself was run by the agenda. That office was held by a woman, thin and wan and brittle-haired. She looked like a cancer victim. Brother Mark introduced Valentine to her. She greeted him gravely, made a polite mention of the power plant, and said she hoped Kentucky would support his command in the manner of allies who'd bled together, and then she moved on to other business. Her handshake was a frail one.
You are no doubt wondering. Some kind of cancer, but it's not public knowledge. She's doing her best to get through the assembly before it claims her.
Brave woman.
From a great old family in Lexington. Our good agenda believes that however this goes, the Currian Order is going to exact their revenge on whoever leads the assembly. She intends to die quietly this winter and deny them the satisfaction.
Once the formalities were taken care of, Brother Mark showed him around the pre-2022 poorly lit convention hall, which smelled like musty carpet and popcorn to Valentine's sensitive nose. A lectern platform stood at one end, with most of the folding chairs around more or less arranged to face it. On the platform was a lectern with its own podium and a small desk just above a discreetly placed recorder's station. The Kentuckians, a smattering of representatives from the Evansville area, and even a delegation from the rebels in West Virginia, He'd hoped Anka would be among them, but the Golden Grog would have stood out among the men like an elk in a goat herd, had gathered into three distinct groups. As Brother Mark explained it, the biggest faction in the room was the Militant Independents. A mixture of legworm clans and burghers, these Kentuckians believed that Kentucky now stood in a position of strength to negotiate with the Northwest Ordnance north of the Ohio and the Tennessee Currians and the Georgia Control to the south. They had a provisional charter drawn up that declared Kentucky a self-governing territory, with a promise not to engage in operations outside its old United States borders, nor to shelter fugitives or guerrillas.
The fugitive law is the real sticking point. Almost everyone in the Legworm clan has a relative or an in-law who fled the Currian zone. They'd be grandfathered in, of course, but there's sympathy for escapees.
How do they know the Currians will go along with it?
I suspect there's already been some back and forth. Rumor has it a top brass ring fixer has been negotiating in Louisville.
Valentine had heard of fixers before. Trusted human intermediaries who handled difficulties between the various Currian zones. Without their intervention, the Currians would eliminate each other in the snake pit world of high-level Currian politicking. Was there a conference going on in, say, Chicago or Cleveland or Atlanta, with Currian representatives meeting to determine what to do about the chaos in Kentucky? He hoped some stealthy cat had managed to worm her way in to listen, or better yet, plant a thermobaric bomb. Next in size among the groups at the assembly was the All-Ins. These delegates represented the Legworm clans gathered under King Karras last summer for Javelin and their supporting towns, the thinned-down remainders of the Kentucky Alliance, who'd done much of the fighting in the destruction of the Moondaggers. They'd already beaten the Moondaggers and were expecting the other delegates to join them in a rebellion well-started, to their minds. The Old Deal Caucus was the smallest contingent, but not surprisingly, the most polished and best turned out. They represented Kentucky's Currian-occupied cities and those with financial interests in the Currian system. They had their chairs in a circle in the far east corner, mostly talking among themselves. Of all the delegates, these men and women from the Old Deal Caucus may have been the most courageous, to Valentine's mind. Their lives, and probably those of their families, would be forfeit if the Currians learned of their presence here. The more hardline rebels considered them only a baby step away from being open collaborators, and Valentine's sharp ears picked up one of the All-Ins saying that they should hang the lot of them. Whichever way the assembly ultimately voted, Valentine suspected that these delegates would suffer the most. Maybe it was just ego. The desire to show Valentine that there were victories to be won in the political arena as well as on the battlefield, but Simi had facilitated Valentine's credentialing on the day he was scheduled to address the assembly on behalf of Southern Command. Simi, looking like a walking advertising poster for skin toner, moved towards the front of the room as the agenda approached the podium from her little desk.
Excuse me. Will everyone kindly take their seats? Thank you. Will distinguished speaker Simi please approach the podium?
Thank you, Madam Agenda. I come before you as a friend of liberty and an open enemy of the Currian Order. This assembly is now addressing the most vital question in human history. What is the future of our species? There are those who counsel for surrender. Certainly, deals may be struck with relative ease. Either the Northwest Ordnance or the Georgia Control would be happy to hand out a few brass rings, sign elaborate guarantees, and offer the usual Currian promises of better food, housing, and medical care in exchange for the Currian Order policing of criminals and troublemakers. Are there any voices who consider this their preferred option? The next option is an understanding with the Currians such as you lived under these past decades. The emasculated autonomy, trading produce for peace, before your martyred hero, Mr. King Karras, declared himself against our oppressors.
Valentine recognized the first ones to applaud as members of Simi's entourage, who were conspicuously sprinkled about the assembly. The others who joined in on the recognition of the dead hero's name looked enthusiastic enough, but Valentine felt a little sickened by the planted enthusiasm. Simi nodded solemnly, looking toward the circled chairs of the Old Deal Caucus.
The rightness of his decision, I think, is not questioned by anyone in this assembly, even if the outcome was not all that we in the Free Republics hoped would come of our alliance. Are there any who think that all the bloodshed across Kentucky between the Alliance clans and Southern Command's forces was wasted?
The representative from through the woods and over the river forgets that Kentucky is more than just legworm ranchers. There are farms, mines, towns, and cities. Not all of us suffered reprisals. Even with the troubles up north, the Nashville Cur left us in peace, and the Georgia Control even pulled back from the borderlands.
Maybe the vamps don't know which way we're jumping, or even whether we're gonna jump, and they don't want to startle us. It's the sitting frog that's easiest to catch.
This assembly will maintain order.
Thank you, Madam Agenda. There is a third alternative. One pursued by the Ozark Free Territory throughout its history, though we have recently been joined by Texas and much of Oklahoma and part of Kansas into the Free Republics. It is both the hardest and the easiest course, that of resistance. I say hardest because it means fighting, funerals, constant vigilance, loss of precious blood and materiel, empty bellies in winter and blistered hands in summer. It has long been said that freedom is not free, but in the United Free Republics we've learned that those who desire freedom pay a bill more costly than the alternatives of supplication or cooperation. Freedom is a more exacting taskmaster than any Kurian lord. Yet it is also the easiest choice, for we can meet the terrible reckoning with a clear conscience that we remain human beings, dignity intact, our births and deaths ordered only by our Lord on his eternal throne. We will not be chickens in a coop or pigs in a pen. No, we're the wolves in the forest, the bears in their caves, and those who would have pelts made from us must beware. While our cause is yours, I must tell you that for the moment, all that Southern Command can promise is that we will tie down as many of the enemy forces as we can on our borders. We've suffered grave losses recently. We need a few years' respite to catch our breath before taking the offensive again. All I can offer the Assembly is moral support and what our forces near Evansville are able to recruit and train. Thank you.
The Assembly hid their feelings well, but Valentine could see consternation in the All-In faction. Valentine could only imagine the reception Simi would have received if he'd promised a whole division of guards, complete with an artillery train and armored car support. Valentine approached Simi later as he watched Brother Mark move from group to group, exchanging a few words with the faction leadership.
Glad you didn't overpromise.
It's the new realism, Valentine.
Putting new in front of anything as tenuous as a word like realism sounds like an excuse rather than a strategy.
Nevertheless, I have to work within the parameters of the possible, just as you do.
And you agree with this new realism?
Of course not. We can't beat the Kurians playing defense.
Something's been bothering me for years, Simi. I hope you don't mind if I ask.
Shoot.
I've met a lot of men who shave their skulls, but your head looks polished. What's your secret?
I'll loan you my razor and we can go over to a wash basin.
On you, it looks distinguished. I would look like a mental patient.
If I let my real hair grow, I'd look much older. Be proud of yours. Not enough gray yet to dismay the 20-year-olds.
I've never had luck with 20-year-olds, even when I was 20. Where will you go next?
You know that joke the Denver Freehold tells about the UFR, don't you?
What's that?
Too near for a penal colony, too big for an insane asylum, and too fractious to be a nation. I heard a similar joke in the Mexican desert, just not so family-friendly in language. I'll return to our insane penal colony nation.
Can't say that I like you, sir, but I'm glad you're with the team.
The feeling is mutual, Major Valentine. By the way, did you enjoy that soap?
The first time they'd met, when Valentine was sitting in prison awaiting trial for the murder of some Quisling prisoners, he'd complimented Simi on the unique smell of his sandalwood soap. Simi had presented him with a supply before the launch of Javelin. Valentine found its aroma relaxing, especially when worked into a fragrant lather in a steaming field tub of water, and had used it frequently during the retreat whenever they paused long enough for a hot bath.
Sadly, yes. Used it up last summer.
I've a spare bar. I'll drop it by your fort on the way out. Oh, I'm taking Moitana back with me. The new broom wants a large reserve of wolves ready to be shifted at need, and Moitana's due for an important promotion. Besides, his replacement has arrived.
Rumor had it the assembly would vote before the first day of winter. Valentine found a reason to hang about the convention hall, hoping to run into Brother Mark in one of his circuits. Valentine enjoyed the late fall air, chill but sunny. It reminded him of the Octobers of his youth in Minnesota. He wondered if the chill was characteristic of Kentucky this time of year. A rather decrepit legworm stood facing the river. It was bare of all baggage, of course. Even the heavy saddle chair had been stripped off, and sheets of plastic tarp protected the legworm from the wind. Battle pads were on the side facing the street, with "Vote for Freedom equals Vengeance" painted on the mattress-like panels in day-glow colors. Valentine felt for the legworm. In cold weather, their instinct was to gather in big heaps, forming domes that warmed and protected their eggs as living nests. This dilapidated old creature had hide hanging off every which way and looked clearly uncomfortable on asphalt, glistening probes out to smell the air. Valentine marked an ancient plastic refuse container holding a mix of leaves and refuse, probably from the quick cleanup of the convention center. Valentine picked it up and dumped it under the legworm's front end. Where was the legworm's pilot? He could at least feed his beast. Valentine looked down at the legworm's torn, perforated side. Skin was falling away in patches from... Nature abhors regularity, and something about the pattern on the legworm's side facing the building disturbed Valentine. Valentine quit breathing, froze. 16 holes in the legworm's side. He lifted a piece of loose skin, saw stitching in the legworm's hide. He looked around, kicked some more refuse under the legworm's nose. He marked rings around the light sensors that passed for eyes. The creature wasn't old. It was ill cared for and badly fed. It had clearly been ridden on very little feed recently. The legworm's anchor detached with a casual press to the carabiner, attaching the drag chains to the fire hydrant serving as a hitching post.
Everyone get away! This worm's a bomb!
Valentine prodded the creature in its sensitive underside with his knife. Valentine crept alongside, keeping low in the gutter, moving the legworm along with shallow stabs. Clear fluid ran down the knife blade, making his hand sticky. The legworm angled left, drawing away from the building as it slowly turned from the conference center, tracing a path as gradual a curve as an old highway on-ramp. Duck walking made his bad leg scream with pain. Valentine waited for the cataclysm that would snuff his life out like a candle in a blast of air. The hungry legworm hit some of the overgrowth at the end of the street. What had once been a pleasant river walk had largely collapsed into brush and small trees. It stopped, distracted.
Come on!
This was about as good as Valentine was going to do. Incredibly, within a few hours of the blast, the assembly had reconvened.
They are ready to vote. They've excluded all non-Kentuckians from the assembly.
Which way do you think it'll go?
Our, or rather, Freedom's way, praise God. You know, that bomb ended up being ironic. It was obviously meant to blow the assembly apart, but it ended up pulling them together. Another foot stuck well into the mouth on the part of the Kurian Order. The one man killed was named Lucius F.B. Lincoln, by the way. A delegate from Paducah. A good name for today's entry into Kentucky history. He ended up doing more for the cause by dying than we'll ever do, should we both live out our 70. The assembly's all talking to one another again. I think they know those shaped charges would have torn through the old dealers or all inns without discriminating according to political belief.
That's a hard way to put it.
It's a hard world. I tell you, Valentine, that bomb couldn't have worked better if we planned it and one of our cats had done it herself.
You don't think we did, I hope.
I don't know that we're that clever.
I'd say ruthless.
Oh, mass manipulation isn't all that hard. I had whole seminars devoted to it. We're herd animals, Valentine. One good startle and we flock together. Then, once you get us going, we all run in the same direction. There's a lot of power in a stampede if you channel it properly.
Perhaps, but it can also send your herd right off a cliff, the way our ancestors used to hunt buffalo. Saved a lot of effort with spears and arrows.
You're a curious creature, son. I can never make out whether you're a shepherd or a wolf.
Black sheep.
No, there's hunter in you.
When I was inducted into the wolves, the Life Weaver warned me I'd never be the same. I'd be forever sundered from my fellow man, or words to that effect. I was too keen to get on with it, to pay much attention.
It's a bargain most of the men in your profession make, and it's a very, very old one. War changes a man, separates him from someone who hasn't seen it. You're both exalted and damned at the same time by the experience.
What about you? You've seen your share of fighting.
Oh, I was damned before I saw my first battlefield.
Valentine was organizing his soldiers to block non-existent traffic 2 blocks away from the convention center, using old rust buckets dragged into position as roadblocks. He learned that Mr. Lincoln, the only man killed by the blast, had been running to jump in the river when the explosives inside the legworm went off. There was some bickering when his underage daughter, who had accompanied him to the assembly, was given his place in the voting. Some said her sobs swayed a few critical votes. Some security. There weren't supposed to be firearms in the conference center. Well, Valentine's men were responsible for the streets. It was the sergeant-at-arms of the assembly who'd been negligent. That, or after the bomb attack, they'd allowed the delegates to arm themselves. Valentine's eyes caught sight of Tika as she tore down the steps. She had a red streamer tied to the barrel of her rifle. The streamer matched the flame in her eyes. She leapt into Valentine's arms and wrapped her hard-muscled legs around his back. Her lips were hot and vital.
The vote was 139 to 31. 5 blanks in protest. Cowards.
For the cause?
I wouldn't have run otherwise. I want to fuck to celebrate. You had a hand in this.
It's all I can afford to put in at the moment. I'm on duty.
Isn't it part of your duty to maintain close contact with your Kentucky allies?
The closest kind of cooperation. We've just had a bomb explode, and no one seems to have any idea who brought a 40-foot legworm into town and how it was parked next to the assembly.
Too bad. May I use your radio? I want to communicate with my command.
Energetic Tika. Denied one piece of equipment, she'll requisition another. Valentine nodded. Tika almost body-checked him in her eagerness to put the headset on. Valentine knew he should really get it confirmed and look at an official roll count for his own report, but he trusted Tika. Valentine noted the time and vote on his duty log and carefully covered the page so the cheap pencil, taken from the narthex of a new universal church where lots are available to write confessions, which were, in practice, accusations against a relative or neighbor, wouldn't smear. You never know what might end up in some museum case.
Yes, put Warfoot into effect and open up the training camps. Oh yeah, that is a big affirmative. Couldn't have gone better. Lost one delegate, but every cause needs a martyr.
Valentine, when he later considered her words over the radio, wondered just how large a role Tika had in Mr. Lincoln's martyrdom. He hoped Tika was just being her usual brutally direct self. What he'd seen of the birth of the Kentucky Freehold was bloody enough, without adding deliberate political murder to the tally. The Kentucky Freehold. Births are messy endeavors. Biological or political. Even the name, Kentucky Freehold, could be considered a mess, because the territory under control of the assembly didn't include her 2 most populous cities. But it did include a few counties in Tennessee, between the Big South Fork and Dale Hollow Lake, and the chunk of Indiana around Evansville. In that winter of 2076, the Kentucky Freehold voted into existence by the assembly was a name only. There wasn't even a cohesive idea behind the name. There was no constitution, no separation of powers, no way to raise money, nor legitimate channels in which to spend it. In the weeks after the vote, the assembly adjourned to their home clans, towns, estates, and businesses to work out quick elections of delegates to the new freehold legislature. The one piece of business the assembly did manage to conduct was to vote into existence an Army of Kentucky, the AOK, as it came to be known.
To effect a
pass to the Southern Command forces in Kentucky, the Assembly reasoned that forces at Fort Sing were installed to help Kentucky, and help, to the Assembly's mind, would flow like water through a pipe from Southern Command's little force to Kentucky. Fort Sing was full of new arrivals. Valentine thought he was dreaming when he met the first of them as he led his companies back from Owensboro. A handsome young black man in wolf deer skins emerged from cover at a good overwatch on the old road running east from Henderson to Owensboro.
Frat, you can't be... You're Moitana's replacement?
Valentine leaned out the open window of his truck, issuing a firm salute and holding out his hand. Valentine hadn't seen Frat in years, since he'd discovered him in Wisconsin living with Molly Carlson's family. Though they'd never served together beyond the events in Wisconsin, Valentine's recommendation had won him a place in the Wolves. The commission Frat had earned on his own.
Major Valentine, welcome back. We've heard the good news about the vote.
Valentine hopped out of the truck, tossing his diaper bag on the seat. He'd decided he liked the bag. He always seemed to be carrying paperwork, and it also comfortably fit a couple of spare pairs of underwear and an extra layer or two in case it turned colder. Frat wore lieutenant's bars and had dark campaign stripes running across the shoulder fabric on his ammunition vest.
Heard you were dead, Major.
I heard the same about you. Lieutenant Carlson, I mean.
Good to see you, sir.
Wolf replacements arrived, then.
My platoon from the reserve. We were part of the Regimental General Reserve. We scouted for the Rio Grande operation. Came home dog-tired and thinking job well done. Got the bad news once we reached Fort Smith. Men still wanted to go back and volunteered. They sent us here instead.
Moitana was a good officer. You can learn a lot from him, even if it's just by a quick changeover briefing and by reading his paperwork. I'll see if I can get a few of his wolves to remain behind to orient your wolves.
Thank you, sir. Actually, I was glad to hear I'll be serving with you. Not exactly again, but...
I know what you mean. It's good to see you too, Lieutenant.
Valentine wondered why Frat was still only a lieutenant. Of course, he was very young, and the wolves had nothing higher than colonel, so there were only so many spaces on the rungs to climb.
I stopped in to see Molly on my way to Jonesboro, Major. She sends her regards. I have a letter from Edward, but, well, you know.
I know.
Valentine found himself looking forward to reading it. Strange, that. He had a biological connection to a girl who barely knew he existed, and an invented fiction connecting him to another man's son. Life like playing jokes with his feelings, rearranging relationships like an old magnetic poetry set.
I'm not the only new arrival. My platoon guided in some civilians. Well, quasi-civilians. But I'll let herself explain it to you.
Valentine and Frat swapped chit-chat the rest of the way back to Fort Sing. Frat made a few inquiries about Valentine's command. There were the most incredible rumors floating around Southern Command about his organization. They were all convicted criminals under death sentence, choosing service instead of the rope. Or Valentine had an all-girl bodyguard of legworm-riding Amazons. Or he was building a private army of freebooters who were stripping Kentucky like locusts of everything from legworm egg hides to bourbon.
Southern Command scuttlebutt. How I miss it.
Back at Fort Sing, Valentine observed some new vehicles in the well-guarded motor lot. The vehicles were an ill-matched set compared to Simi's quick-moving column and looked better suited for extensive off-road operation. They had extra tires and cans marked diesel, gas, and water mounted on them. He had reported to Lambert first, who only told him that they had a new set of headaches for the battalion, but that it might work out to the benefit of the cause in general, and the battalion in particular. Then he drank a large cold glass of milk. It was goat's milk, cow milk had run out, and went out to observe the arrivals. They were equally interested in meeting him. Frat offered to introduce him to the visitors. The gathering looked like a small, well-armed gypsy camp, filled with people in neatly mended surplus uniforms that had a sort of broken double ring stitched on the shoulders. If Valentine had been forced to describe the woman following the corporal walking up to him, he would have said statuesque. Her face, under a bush hat with the brim stuck up on the left with a jaunty feathered pin, might have been molded alabaster. He put her age as 40-ish, or a very youthful-looking 50, though her eyes danced with an ageless sparkle, blue ice on fire. She wore a long leather skirt and steel-tipped jodhpur boots with thick canvas half-chaps, and she evidently knew enough about uniforms to pick him out as the ranking officer.
Visitor at camp, Major. Mrs. O'Coombe with the Southern Command travel warrant.
Mrs. O'Coombe.
Major Valentine.
Mrs. Okum's challenging grip and steady eye contact marked her as a Texan. Valentine knew the name Okum. The family owned the largest cattle ranch in the United Free Republics. Some said it stretched beyond the official borders. Now that he had a name, he even recognized the emblem on their fatigues, the Hooked OC. They were said to be fabulously wealthy, at least as such things were measured in the Freehold.
I've read about you on several occasions, as I recall, Major. You're just the man I want to see about my venture to Kentucky. I have here, Mr. Valentine, a letter from the President himself. President Stark was a good friend of my late husband's. He dined on our ranch on three occasions while in office. He was a frequent visitor before.
She reached into her hacking jacket and removed a folded manila envelope. The letter within had a foil seal over a red and blue ribbon with the outgoing presidential signature and a notation indicating it had been transcribed by his personal secretary. After noting that it was simply addressed to Officer, Executive, or Mariner Commanding and contained some polite words of thanks, Valentine read the meat of the letter.
Please offer whatever aid and assistance to Mrs. Bethany Okum you consider practical. The retrieval and return of any and all of our wounded left behind on last summer's retreat would be, in my opinion, invaluable to our cause as well as the morale of the forces of Southern Command. Mrs. Okum is a personal friend of mine. She can be trusted with Southern Command information and material relevant to her plans. Her signature would be accepted on any equipment voucher if she requests the use of any device or machine. I would consider it a singular favor for you to offer her any assistance that does not materially endanger your other duties.
A crusader. Valentine had seen a few in his time, dedicated to relieving Southern Command of the evils of drink or the dangers of professional women and syphilis. This woman was clearly here to do more than give a few speeches, take a few oaths, or show some slides of tertiary cases. Were these vehicles a specialized medical train to care for the few wounded that remained in Fort Sing's small hospital?
I would be delighted to accommodate you, Mrs. Okum. Please tell me, how may I be of service?
I understand that during the battles of this summer, some wounded were left behind with such of our Kentucky allies who could be trusted with their safety. I would like to help recover them. From what I understand of your expertise, Mr. Valentine, you have a good deal of experience going in and getting people out of difficulty. I've hoped that you could aid me from the first I heard.
Why here, Mrs. Okum? As a Texan, I think you'd be more interested in the Rio Grande Valley. More troops were involved in that action, I believe. I suspect there are more wounded scattered around southern Texas than we have here. We had the advantage of legworms, you see. All but our worst cases could be moved while remaining in their beds. Or hammocks, rather.
I have a personal interest, Mr. Valentine. I recently learned my son was among those left behind as your column retreated from the mountains.
Her gaze wavered a little, and Valentine saw what he suspected to be tears.
I have come to get him back. I should like you to guide me across Kentucky. As you're the one who left our soldiers scattered across the Cumberland, I expect you would be the one best able to help me retrieve them.
I would suggest that you speak to my commanding officer, ma'am.
Lambert heard Mrs. Okum out and invited her to enjoy what hospitality Fort Sing could provide while she considered the matter. Could she perhaps return this evening for dinner, and there they could discuss the matter in detail? Mrs. Okum was much obliged and said she'd be delighted. Valentine was curious, a little aggravated, and anything but delighted at Lambert's response. He decided to clarify things as soon as Mrs. Okum had left the building.
You're not considering sending me across Kentucky as a tour guide for that stack of grief, I hope, sir.
I'm certainly inclined to let her have you. Apart from wanting our wounded back and safe, the gratitude of the Hooked OC is well worth having. I expect she'll be as influential with the new president as the old.
I didn't even know her son was with us. Usually Southern Command tells us when we have to deal with a scion of the carriage trade. Quietly, but they tell us.
Someone slipped up. Noble of him to volunteer. Mom passed down something besides Texas sand.
Valentine didn't have a number one uniform worthy of a formal dinner with Lambert and their important guest. His least patched ensemble was the militia corporal's uniform he wore when traveling in Southern Command, but that had bloodstains on it now, and no effort of soap or will could eradicate them. He settled for the moondagger robes he'd worn the night he'd taken out the young Kurian,
with his leaf clipped on the collar and a Southern Command tricolor pinned to the shoulder. David Valentine wasn't one to stand in front of a mirror admiring himself, but he had to admit the Moondagger robe uniform suited him. The various shades of black complemented his skin and dark hair and made his perfectly ordinary brown eyes look a little more striking when set in all that black. His old legworm boots gave him some dash and swagger with their silver accents. The scars on the left side of his face had healed down to not much more than big wrinkles and a pockmark, and the old companion descending his right cheek looked more like the romantic scarring of a dread pirate than the stupid souvenir of nearly having his head blown off. The dinner was held in the conference room, complete with a white lace tablecloth and candlesticks. It turned out he needn't have worried about his appearance. Colonel Lambert had invited an eclectic company to her dinner. Mrs. Okum was there in her same field skirt and little lace-up boots, only now garbed in a silken blouse and a, Valentine couldn't find the word for it, stole? It was a leather half-vest that went around behind her neck and hung down in two narrow pleats in front with bright brass emblems. All Valentine could think of was sleigh bells on a horse. Fort Sing's three logistic commando wagon masters were there as well, two Western Kentucky specialists, and one more they'd hauled all the way to the Appalachians and back. They smelled faintly of stock animals and sweat, but they'd combed their hair and flattened it with oil. Patel wore his new Legion-style captain's uniform and had polished his two canes. That was a bit unlike Nile Patel. He was more the type to grit his teeth through an evening of aching knees and retire with a bottle of aspirin. Lambert looked trim and neat, as one would expect, her hair brushed and shaped by a dress clip for the use of female officers. And finally, Alessa Duvalier stood next to the fire, warming her backside, and dressed in a little black outfit that must have been liberated from the basement, perhaps from some formal ball of the great man's daughter. A red bra peeked from behind the low-cut front. Valentine vaguely thought it was a sartorial faux pas, but Duvalier's red hair, spiky and disarrayed as usual, made it work. Odd assortment. If Lambert wanted to impress Mrs. Okum, why not invite Captain Ediac with her model cheekbone looks and polished Eastern manners? Why not Gamecock, who had a courtliness all his own behind the braids and scars, smooth as his rolling accent, that showed off some collective unconscious vestige of the grace of old South Carolina? Brother Mark, the other obvious candidate, was off on a junket with the agenda from the late assembly. Or, more correctly, the soon-to-be late agenda. They were arranging for the establishment of a temporary government in Kentucky, and the ex-churchman wanted to plead for an office devoted to relations with allies in the cause. Valentine joined Duvalier at the fire.
What the hell is that, Val?
It's the nicest thing I have that fits me. Some Moondagger's dress-up outfit.
I've seen those before. That's what they wear when they have a date with a Reaper. They treat it like a wedding.
You're kidding.
No joke.
Well, it's still an attractive ensemble. I like how it looks, so what the hell?
Your funeral.
Lambert finished making her introductions, and everyone sat. Valentine sat opposite Lambert with Patel on one side and Duvalier on the other, with the logistics commandos near them. Mrs. Okum was in the place of honor to Lambert's right. Patel fiddled with his array of silverware.
Which is the one to clean the grease from one's lips, Major?
You can dip your fingers in the finger bowl and touch them to your lips when you're done eating.
The dishes came out. It was a meager dinner, rationed beef and seasoned patties made from falafel and corn that would probably be allocated to the pigs on Mrs. Okum's ranch. Lambert, as host, got the logistics commandos talking about their difficulty finding even food staples, with Southern Command currency worthless here and what was left of Colonel Bloom's booty pile diminishing rapidly.
They want gold or curry and bank guarantees or valuables for trade. We're out of all the usual stuff we trade. Our depots don't have dynamite or two-way radios, not even paper and ink or razor blades.
The vote didn't change nothing.
We could send a few wolves with the LCs on their next run, sir. Give them a choice of Southern Command scrip or lead.
No.
Been done before, Major.
We're trying to teach these recruits that just because you've got a uniform and a gun, whatever you can grab is not yours for the taking. We have to set an example. Tighten our belts.
We'll be eating our belts before winter's up at this rate.
Mr. Valentine, I couldn't help overhearing your conversation regarding the supply difficulties. I'm traveling with a substantial amount of gold and carrying bills of guarantee.
I've dealt on both sides of the border often enough to know that one needs hard assets and negotiables to overcome certain bureaucratic difficulties.
Excuse me, madam, but where did you get bills?
Bills were certificates guaranteeing employment, useful or otherwise, for a set period, usually 5 or 10 years. They were extremely difficult to forge. Some said the seals acted in much the same manner as a brass ring, and they were very valuable in the Kurian zone. Many an old-timer would trade his entire life's accumulation for a 5-year certificate. She read Patel's scowl.
If you think I trade cattle on both sides of no man's land out of greed, Captain Patel, you're wrong, sir. I sometimes find it useful to bribe for or buy what I cannot obtain in the free republics.
Of course we'd be grateful for your assistance. What can you spare?
I can give you 6,000 sea coin in gold and 6 Kurian 5-year bills. You will, of course, sign a promissory note that I may redeem back at Fort Smith for their cash value, assessed per logistic commando fair market pricing of whichever month is current when I turn them in.
Southern Command, perpetually starved for precious metals, would be thrilled to have Mrs. Okum show up demanding $100 gold coins by the roll. Frontier posts kept gold on hand for smugglers coming out of the Kurian zone with antibiotics or computer chips or hard intelligence, and they'd be loath to part with it for nothing but a promissory note from a written-off outpost. How would the loan change the status of Mrs. Okum on the post? The men would learn she was buying their cornmeal and chickens and bacon one way or another. Suppose she started issuing them orders as though they were her bunkhouse cowpunchers. Still, the men had to be fed one way or another. The only other option would be to go in and take it at gunpoint, and they weren't pirates, at least not yet. Valentine weighed his options. Once Kentucky got itself organized, Fort Sing would petition for support from the Assembly. Though Valentine wondered if his forces, being neither fish nor fowl, so to speak, would find themselves divested of support from both the rebels in Kentucky and his own Southern Command, especially once General Martinez took over and instituted his new defensive policies. Mrs. Okum waited, her hands clasped decorously in her lap. She'd only nibbled politely at the meager fare.
Madam, I accept your very generous offer on behalf of my men.
Always willing to help the cause, Colonel Lambert. Now, Mr. Valentine, perhaps you will attend to the matter of facilitating me in the effort of finding my son. I would like your advice on routes and what sort of personnel we should bring.
A complicated question, ma'am. Depends on supply capacity in your vehicles, what sort of fuel they need.
Well, if Valentine was going to take her gold, he'd get more for it than butter and eggs. Valentine hemmed and hawed his way through conversation about the trip to recover her son, and others, of course, and as usual, struck upon an idea while his brain was busy fencing with Mrs. Okum. Valentine escaped Mrs. Okum the next day, pleading that he had to go into Evansville to see about purchasing supplies. Evansville had an impressive city hall, thanks to the region's ample limestone, but it reminded Valentine of a church with long-dead parishioners. Most of the offices were empty. They should have used the empty rooms for the overflowing waiting room. Luckily, his uniform brought him right to the attention of the city's governor.
Right this way, Major.
How they arrived at governor, Valentine didn't know then, but he later learned that since Evansville considered itself a different state than Kentucky, even though it was now part of the Kentucky freehold, by definition it should have a governor as chief executive. In this case, the governor was a former member of the underground named Durand. Professor Durand, actually. He ran a secret college devoted to preserving classical Western education from the tailoring, trimming, and alteration of the Kurian order. He reminded Valentine a bit of Trotsky in his dress and glasses, minus the brains and the talent and the vigor. Durand was sorting papers into 4 piles on his desk when Valentine entered. Valentine would have sworn in court that he recognized some of the documents from his last visit 3 weeks ago, before the action at the power station, when he unsuccessfully pleaded for the Evansville Provisional Government to purchase supplies for Fort Sing.
Can I help you, Major Valentine?
You've done so much already, Governor. I'm simply here to pay my respects before we depart. A last duty call before I plunge into getting the camp relocated.
Depart?
Yes, the fort will be relocated. For security reasons, I can't disclose our destination, but the town's leadership has made a most generous offer, and strategically it makes sense. We'll be closer to the center mass of Kentucky, able to operate on interior lines. You know the military advantages.
But the underground has word of an armored column north of here. Cannon, armored cars, riot buses, gunnebagos.
Yes. How is the city militia progressing in its training? Well, the key is to brush back the infantry support, then it's much easier to take out the armor.
You've made so many improvements to your camp, I understand. Hot water, electricity.
Perhaps your militia can relocate and take advantage of all our hard work. True, that would mean longer response time if you needed them to deal with, say, some airdropped Reapers.
What is this other town offering you?
Offering? I'm doing my duty, Professor, not engaging in bid-taking.
Surely Evansville has its advantages. The textile plant, the appliances, our phone system.
All are superior to central Kentucky, I grant you. But my men are running short on eggs and dairy and fresh meat and vegetables. The new town has offered to supply us amply. I have to consider the health and fitness of my men. Of course, we'll have more difficulty purchasing building materials, tenting, plumbing supplies, munitions, uniforms, and such in Kentucky. After I've finished here, I'll visit the marketplace and see if I can't have a selection packed and ready for transport.
Well, we've had something of a food crisis here as well. It appears to be easing since the vote to declare openly against the Kurian Order. We've been neglectful of our protectors across the river. Now we could easily restart the flow of foodstuffs. I expect a boat full of chickens and eggs could be put across in no time.
I know this is pretty long for a grocery list, but this is what we'll need every week.
Now, Major, basic staples shouldn't be difficult, but chocolate?
Some of my soldiers have a sweet tooth, but I imagine most of it will end up in the stomachs of Evansville's beautiful young women.
You drive a hard bargain, Major. Is this quite ethical, extorting the people you promised to protect?
Evansville's delegates voted to support the armed resistance to the Kurian Order in men and materiel. I have most of the men I need. My material needs are small compared to the army they're trying to build outside the Kurian Triangle. You might consider yourself lucky.
It appears we are bound to be symbionts, Major. I'll see to the deliveries of your foodstuffs.
Then we shall be happy to remain in our comfortable and beautiful surroundings, with the congenial company of Evansville and Owensboro.
I'm sure. I can't say I don't feel as though I've been played like a harp.
If that column comes roaring south out of Bloomington, you'll be glad we stayed. Or you might end up playing your own harp, sir.
He didn't want to go on Mrs. Okum's expedition. He wished Moitana were still present. It would have been a much better assignment for a group of experienced wolves. It took a direct order from Lambert to get him to agree to do it. They talked it over across her desk. Lambert had a policy that in private, when seated, you could talk to her without military formalities and treat her as a sounding board rather than a commander. It was a tradition Valentine had always followed with his own subordinates. Valentine remembered picking it up from Captain LaHave. He wondered if Lambert had acquired it from Moira Stiakowski. Or did it come to Lambert from Valentine in a roundabout way?
That's a blank ad hoc special duty personnel sheet. Take whoever you like, just none of my captains.
I was going to say Patel.
Tough luck. Say someone else.
I was thinking Two Bears, a wolf scouting team. Allie.
Duvalier is a captain.
Seeing as she's a cat, I was thinking you could make an exception.
All right. Approved. Medical staff?
They have enough to do here. Our patroness says she has her own medical team.
Why don't you take Bolnitz, too? He's been making himself a nuisance here. I don't know if he's filed a story yet.
Maybe he's working on a novel.
Valentine observed that Lambert's desk was as clean as an Archon's shaving mirror. Lambert managed to do a tremendous amount of work. She was in the process of reorganizing Fort Sing from the top down, but there was no evidence of it except for a three-drawer file cabinet and a brace of three-ring binders. Her clerk was always buzzing in and out like a pollen-laden honeybee, keeping the binders updated.
I'd hate to be away if that column moves south.
We'll just call you back. Mrs. Okum can delay them with a pillar of fire and then spread her arms and part the Tennessee for us to get away.
Valentine couldn't say why he didn't like the idea of leaving Fort Sing. How do you put disquiet and restlessness into words? Normally, he'd look forward to picking up his men and getting them on the road home. That sort of thing left a better aftertaste than surviving a battle. One more thing bothered him. Red Dog had appeared a little nervous of late, always looking around with the whites of his eyes showing and hiding under tables and stonework. He'd even been dragged out from under the defunct hot tub in the estate house's garden gazebo.
Red Dog had been a tool of the Kurians in the retreat across Kentucky when one Kurian had somehow linked through the Dog's mind to Javelin's commanders at headquarters. If Red Dog was nervous, Valentine was nervous.
Nice work at the dinner. I think when Mrs. Okum had to eat what we've been living on, it encouraged her to part with her gold.
I just think she's a deeply decent person. You don't often meet one of those.
I met one back at the War College in Pine Bluff. Little stick of a thing, always dotting I's and crossing T's.
And I remember a shy young lieutenant who was always looking at his shoes and talking about the weather when he should have been asking me to a dance.
We were both too busy, I think.
And now we're in a fort where Southern Command rules on down-chain, up-chain, and cross-chain fraternization will be strictly observed. And not strictly in the fun, blindfold, and handcuffs sense, either.
Dirty bird, Colonel. Hands off.
That goes for your captain, too, Major.
Oh, Neelay Patel and I share a love that cannot
You know who I mean. I don't want Bolnitz returning to his paper with an episode of Noonside Passions ready for action.
Yes, ma'am. But rest easy. Ediac didn't earn that rapid rise the hard way.
You're impossible, Valentine! Anyway, let's keep it zipped up for once, shall we?
As long as you restrain yourself with Bolnitz. You've made time for how many interviews?
I don't recall him being in the chain of command. And if he were, I'd just have my clerk make a new page minus his name. But point taken, Valentine. Honestly, the only thing I want to get intimate with is that hot tub. If Prist and Takanita get it functional again...